Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Barack Obama accepted the nomination for the presidency from the Democratic Party in front of more than 84,000 people packed into a football stadium in Denver. John McCain released a television ad congratulating Obama. But the gloves come off today when the Republican presumptive nominee is expected to unveil his choice for a running mate. Joining me here in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, and from CBS Radio Studios in Denver, Naftali Ben-David of the Chicago Tribune, and Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. I'm sure many of you have been watching the events all week and have comments, questions for our commentators. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, Eleanor.
Good morning, Diane.
I'm glad you're here. I know you came in last night. Naftali Ben-David, are you still functioning?
I am, but it's been a long week.
And how about you, Matthew Continetti?
I'm here, Diane, and happy to be here.
I'm delighted to have you all. And I do hope our listeners will join us. Eleanor Clift last night in Barack Obama's speech. He said, "It's not about me, it's about you." How successful was his message?
Well, that was a theme that Hillary Clinton struck in her speech also, to get her supporters to back Barack Obama, saying, did you support me because of me, or did you support me because of all of these issues? And I think that that was the message that I want to say Senator Obama, but I guess now it's presidential nominee Obama, that he needed to get across, that this isn't about his, you know, celebrity candidacy, that he's there in order to challenge all of these issues. And I must say, the historic nature of the moment, the fact it's his singular achievement, but it's an achievement of America as a country. And I think it gives us hope that we can take on these other difficult, I would say, moral issues too, the bankruptcy of the country, the war, climate change, and all of the significant problems facing the next president.
Naftali, do you think that Barack Obama was able, through his address, to make clear his positions on those issues?
I do. I mean, I think it was another in a long line of terrific Obama speeches, and I think one of his goals was to provide slightly more policy details than he has in the past. People have talked about how his oratory is great and lofty and soaring, but he sometimes doesn't convey the specifics of what exactly he would do and what change and hope actually mean in the practical lives of everyday people. And I think there's a little bit more of an attempt to do that. It wasn't terribly detailed, but there were some more specifics. And I think it was a pretty well interwoven speech that hit some high notes with some of those more practical messages.
Matthew Continetti, how did you react?
I thought, of course, the moment was historic and very moving, the stadium literally shaking at times throughout the course of the evening. At other moments, I thought the speech was defensive. He sought fit to mention the celebrity critique that this very effective ad by John McCain. He spent paragraphs assuring the country of his patriotism, though McCain has never questioned his patriotism. He even mentioned the campaign slogan for next week's Republican convention, putting country first, saying we all put our country first. So much of the speech was a direct response to McCain. A feeling I got from that was that the Obama campaign has been shaken up. And then, of course, there were many evasions. You know, Obama has this fantastic way to kind of cloud the differences, the ideological differences that divide the country. But the problem is that those differences are real. And when it comes to governing a job that he wants, he's going to have to choose a position. Now, we kind of know already where his positions are, but I think he should be a little bit more frank about saying them.
If I could jump in here.
Sure,
sorry,
go ahead, Naftali.
Just the idea that John McCain has never questioned his patriotism. I think when you say on several occasions that somebody would be willing to lose a war in order to win an election, I'm not clear what the distinction is between that and questioning someone's patriotism or love of their country.
All right.
If you'd be willing to have your country lose a war for your own political advancement, to me that's a pretty fine line.
What about the ideological differences that continue or may continue to exist within the Democratic Party itself, within Democratic voters themselves, Elner?
Ideological differences over gun control? I thought he did a very good job of diffusing those issues and pointing out the areas of agreement, because this is not an election that should be fought over the Second Amendment. It should be fought over the future of the Supreme Court, and that does tie in certainly to reproductive rights. But I think he pushed for wording in the platform that goes back to the early Clinton years to make abortion legal, safe, and rare. So I think that's been his gift, is to find the areas in American life where he can bring people together. And I think sometimes that comes across as sort of small bore reforming, but in other areas, I think he really believes if you can fix the process, you can fix the policies.
Elner Clift of Newsweek, Naftali Ben-David of the Chicago Tribune, Matthew Continetti of the Weekly Standard. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Matthew, let's talk about Senator Clinton and former President Bill Clinton. How did you perceive their speeches? Did they do enough to bring unity to the party after that long campaign?
I think there may have been a sense after Senator Clinton's speech that she really didn't do enough to endorse Obama. But then the next night we had President Clinton's speech, which went over the top in assuring the country. I think the key graph in President Clinton's speech was his assurance to the nation, and this is a former commander-in-chief speaking, that Obama was ready to take the oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. A very powerful moment, I thought. I also thought it interesting, Diane, that the two most effective speeches of this convention, in my opinion, which were the two Clinton speeches, were also the two speeches that the Obama campaign had the least control over. And then we found later that another real rabble-rouser of a speech, that of Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer, was also completely freelanced by Schweitzer. He totally departed from the text that the Obama campaign wanted. So I think that the Obama campaign wanted a very effective convention, but what we found, though, is that the best moments of it were those out of its control.
And to you, Naftali Ben-David, did the two Clintons do what they needed to do to unify her supporters behind Barack Obama?
You know, I think they did everything that they possibly could have. No one could watch those speeches and feel that maybe they didn't go as far as they were asked to go. To me, the most effective moment actually in Hillary Clinton's speech is where she asked her supporters, did you vote for me because of me or because of that boy in Iowa or wherever it was who doesn't have health care and that veteran who doesn't have benefits? She tried to raise the campaign to a higher level and almost suggest that it would be petty of her voters to be too hung up on her instead of on the bigger issues facing the country. Now, I do think it's hard to tell whether the party is sufficiently unified. I think this convention has done about all it could in that direction, but we have a couple more months of an election now, and I think we'll see during those couple months just how successful the whole thing was.
And how well, Elner, did the selection of Joseph Biden as Barack Obama's running mate go over with that convention delegation? How well was he received?
He was received superbly. I mean, Joe Biden has been transformed into a rock star in the eyes of Democrats. His energy and the fact that he does personify middle class life and values and is really in touch with the folks in the diner at the gas station, and the personal challenges in his life that he's overcome. When his son introduced him and the cameras went to Michelle Obama, I mean, you could see her tearing up. A lot of people were tearing up. And, you know, Joe Biden clearly so much loves being there. And I think that he is sort of the achievement of every working class Catholic in the Northeast. I heard Chris Matthews say, Jack Kennedy was a prince, but Joe Biden is one of us.
And, interesting.
Yeah, and,
Eleanor,
and I think he's a very good choice.
Give us a sense, just for our listeners, who've seen, you know, all the glory portrayed on their television screens. Mm-hmm. Give us a sense of the reality of being there on the ground.
I know. My son, one of my three sons, would have loved to be there. And I kept telling him he was seeing more on television than I was seeing. I mean, the press, thousands of press, were headquartered in these big tents, and we use porta-johns. And the day becomes a hunt, foraging for food, and, you know, getting into the hall. And it's magic to be in the hall, and you do feel like you're there on a stage set of history. But you really can't see a whole lot, and you talk to a few delegates here and there. And then if you really want to know what's going on, you go back and watch television. Yes, I mean, that's the reality. And Denver seemed in some ways to be unprepared because it was very difficult to get around. It was a huge perimeter around the Pepsi Center that you had to walk to get to the edge of before you could then try to hail a cab. It's not like Washington and New York where you put your arm out and you get a cab. And so it was thousands of people competing for cabs.
Neftali, was that your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that there were some logistical difficulties, but I feel that there is something sort of spectacular about being there. There's been so much talk in recent years about how conventions are heavily scripted and choreographed, and of course they are. But nonetheless, they're the party's attempt to show its best face to the public, and to be there when it does that and see how successful that is, I think is a great thing.
Naftali Ben-David, he's Washington Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune and author of The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. Short break. We'll be right back. And here's our first email from Dinah in Dallas, Texas, who says, please ask your panel to comment on my new hero, Barney Smith. I watched him over and over last night. Wow, what a great line that truly conveys so much truth about the middle class and the heartland. And that line, we need a president who puts Barney Smith before Smith Barney. Tell us about his appearance.
He was one of five ordinary Americans from the campaign trail who told their story. He'd been unceremoniously, just laid off and just kicked to the side. And so he said, we need a president who cares more about Barney Smith, who he is, than Smith Barney. And the hall just roared. I must say, these five people who told their stories, can you imagine getting up in front of, 84,000 people? And they were all, wonderfully authentic. I don't think the Obama campaign wrote their speeches. Maybe they help them a little, who knows? But boy, this was all from the heart.
And here's an email. Let's see. The Democratic convention this week had a great deal of symbolism, from Senator Clinton speaking on the anniversary of women's right to vote to Senator Obama giving his acceptance speech on the anniversary of the March on Washington, I feel Senator Obama giving his speech at Invesco Field was a way of saying that his campaign was for all people, not just for insiders. I'm curious what your panel thinks. Matthew Continetti.
Well, it certainly, Diane, was a convention that was draped in history. The resonances were all over the place, not only to Martin Luther King Jr. Or the, you know, the suffragettes who campaigned for the 19th Amendment, but also Abraham Lincoln in the kind of the vision of the portico that that was behind Obama when he spoke. As well as John F. Kennedy, who, of course, was the last president to accept the nomination, or rather presidential candidate to accept the nomination of his party in an outdoor arena. What I thought the Obama campaign achieved with the Invesco Field appearance last night was really spectacular. A lot of us in the press were doubting whether this event would be able to come off as, you know, or just come off well. The accusation of hubris of celebrity, of course, was already being raised. But what Obama really did, what the campaign did last night, was transform Invesco Field, this huge stadium, into a very intimate setting for speeches from all over. And so I thought that was very effective.
It was also a fantastic organizing tool. They have data on everybody in that stadium, and they're going to go out and multiply their enthusiasm.
I see.
If I could add to that,
go ahead, Naftali.
Thank you. I mean, I think that it was a terrific convention by most measures. It was spectacular. The symbolism was powerful. The speeches were great. But, you know, there's a lot of hard work to do in the next 2 months. And I think Obama has a very specific task ahead of him, and that's to convince people that he understands their problems and that he's on their side. He knows what their lives are about and he can make them better, because it's one thing to be a powerful symbol, and it's something else to convey that you can really change somebody's life for the better. And I think that that's something that both he and McCain, I think in a way that's what this election's going to be about over the next 2 months.
Now, Naftali, what did you think of John McCain's ad congratulating Obama?
Well, I was of two minds about it, to tell you the truth. It was, you know, I thought in a way a very classy thing for on the night of Senator Obama accepting the nomination, for his opponent to say, look, we go at each other a lot, but on this occasion, let me just say congratulations, job well done. On the other hand, that campaign has aired some pretty harsh attack ads, some pretty negative things. Some of them, I think, demonstrably untrue. And so there was something a little comical about this just river, I guess, of harsh denunciation, mitigated only by one day of courteous pleasantries.
Matthew. Yeah.
Eleanor. Okay.
Matthew, go ahead.
It's a political campaign. The Obama campaign, of course, throughout the past few weeks on the state level, not the national ad buys that the McCain campaign has been doing, but in various states have been running very tough attacks on McCain's record on the economy. Factcheck.org says one of those ads contains some of the very same falsehoods Naftali is accusing McCain campaign of saying. So it's a political campaign. I thought the ad was interesting. There were a lot of rumors preceding the evening that McCain was going to try to step on Obama's moment by announcing his vice presidential pick. In the same way that McCain tried to step on Obama's moment earlier this summer when Obama finally won enough pledged delegates to claim the nomination. If you recall, he gave that pretty bad speech in front of the green background and using McCain using the Obama line, change we can believe in. McCain said that's not change we can believe in. It wasn't a successful speech. But I thought this ad, though, was a successful way for McCain to kind of insert himself very subtly into the Democratic convention.
Well, first of all, it would have to be a heck of a vice presidential choice to have stepped on the moment last night. I mean, that is totally ridiculous. And secondly, I thought it was a very nice ad and a very nice gesture on John McCain's part. And I'm not going to overthink it. I think I'll accept it, and I'll bet most Americans will accept it. And that's what people want to see. People do want to see a civility.
All right. So the battle begins today with a rally scheduled for noon in Ohio when John McCain is, we assume, going to announce his vice presidential choice. Matthew Continetti, we've heard all kinds of rumors. What are you hearing?
Well, the latest speculation, Diane, focuses on Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. She's a pro-life conservative elected to the office in 2006. She's a lifetime member of the National Rifle Association. She has several children, one of whom has a Down syndrome. This pick, if it were to happen, would be quite a game changer in that it's a direct appeal for women voters on McCain's part. And also, Palin is known in Alaska for combating the kind of the forces of corruption and the status quo there. People like Senator Ted Stevens and Representative Don Young, who, of course, won earlier this week.
Indeed.
Their respective primaries,
right.
a sign that, you know, which is a very troubling sign for the Congressional Republican Party for this convention. But McCain, if he were to pick Palin, could say this is a pro-life reformer, anti-corruption candidate who is not tainted at all by Washington. I think it would be a smart choice.
Naftali.
Yeah, I think we're also hearing that it's probably going to be her. And I think in a way this is a bid for some of the star quality, some of the youth, some of the barrier breaking that Obama embodies. And I think this is a choice very much driven by who McCain's opponent is and an attempt to adopt some of those qualities. I think the risk is that she is also, like Obama, young, inexperienced in foreign policy. I think questions would be raised about whether or not she's ready to become president. I think it would blunt the impact of some of the complaints of Republicans that Obama himself is unprepared. If McCain has I think she's 44 or something like that, served, I think, one term as governor of a small state, doesn't have foreign policy experience. So it's a very interesting choice that I think in some ways brings both the benefit and the liabilities that Obama himself brings to the Democrats.
Eleanor.
She's been my sort of dark horse for some time after I saw a profile of her and the way that she has taken on reform and taken on the oil companies in Alaska.
However, just interrupt here to say that both Politico and the Chicago Tribune are saying that Republican sources are confirming Governor Palin is the vice presidential pick. Fox is saying sources backstage are telling them the same thing.
Right. I think she's could be a good campaigner and a great VP contender, but I think given the fact that John McCain turned 72 years old today, can she pass that threshold test of being seen as an instant president? I don't see how the McCain people can carry on their attack against Barack Obama is not ready when they're teeing her up when it seems to me she has less experience than Barack Obama.
The campaign is neither confirming nor denying the statements from Politico and the Chicago Tribune. Then there's another question. Matthew Continetti, what are the chances the GOP may actually have to delay the start of its convention currently scheduled to begin on Monday?
That's right. Of course, Gustav, the storm bearing toward the Gulf Coast has raised a lot of concerns among Republicans. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal is saying he may not attend the convention should it strike Louisiana. And there are, I can report, there are some sort Republican sources who are actually privately hoping that President Bush may decide to skip the convention in order to go to the Gulf Coast and kind of oversee the preparations there. It would be kind of a coup for the McCain campaign if George Bush didn't show up to the Republican National Convention.
Wow, that's quite a statement, Matthew.
Well, I think it's clear. I mean, you're running for a third Republican term of the presidency to replace a president who has, you know, historic lows in popular approval. So there are serious worries about the McCain campaign. And these were the most effective moments, I thought, of the Democratic convention when various speakers were able to link McCain to Bush, something that can be hard to do at times. And I also would say that the pick of Sarah Palin for vice presidential candidate, should it be her, would be an effective tool to kind of say, I'm different. You know, Palin's been in Alaska, for God's sakes, for the past 4 years. She is not tied to the Bush legacy. So I think that would be effective.
Okay. And speaking of Alaska, you mentioned that Ted Stevens had won the Alaska GOP primary. Can somebody explain to me his substantial victory, Naftali?
Well, he is somebody who is seen as having done tremendous things for the state of Alaska. He's been there for an incredibly long time, one of the longest serving members of Congress. But he's also brought a lot of attention and money and funding and stature to a state that hasn't always had it. And I think there's a lot of loyalty to him. It's not that unusual that you see sometimes figures who might have a dubious reputation on the national stage being somewhat more beloved in their home state simply because people know them and they have brought a lot of benefit to that state. But I think the bigger picture here really is something that Matthew alluded to earlier, which is it's probably bad news for the congressional Republicans simply because he's not likely to win the general election. And it's one of a series of problems that the Republicans have actually had throughout the country, some of them due to bad luck, some of them due to the political climate, that suggests that they may lose quite a few more seats in Congress this November. We've all been paying attention to the presidential race, but there are some important things happening on the congressional level as well.
Eleanor.
Ted Stevens delivers, and to continue the theme of the convention, it's not about him, it's about the voters, and he's delivered for the state. But he'll probably be gone once the November election takes place.
But what's the status of his trial?
Well, he's got two fights ahead of him. One is, his trial, his courtroom, and then the election. And I suspect he's not going to prevail in either.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek at 27 before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones first to Silver Spring, Maryland. Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for giving me the chance.
Sure.
Diane, to look to the future a little bit, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, it was quietly announced about the presidential debates. And it looks like, again, we're going to have that same fake press conference format that we always have. My question is just this. With two candidates who are so verbally adept, with so many real issues to argue about, why can't we have real debates?
What would a real debate look like to you, Stephen?
Sit them down, have a moderator to keep them, to pull them off each other if they start punching. But other than that, to stay out of the way. Let them ask each other questions. Let them respond to each other. Let's get into some nuts and bolts here.
Now, I understand that Jim Lehrer is hosting, moderating one of those debates. Tom Brokaw is doing another. And who's doing the third? Is it Charlie Gibson?
I don't think it's Charlie
Gibson. No, okay.
I believe it is Charlie Gibson.
Is it?
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. Now, what's the chance for a debate like that,
Eleanor? Well, this is just what the caller described, a single moderator, and then you have the two candidates. But the two candidates' campaigns will probably get involved to set some ground rules. And let's see how daring each side is. If it looks too stilted, you remember the red light, the green light. they had 90 seconds to respond.
Right.
Maybe they, if you could get rid of some of those time constraints, but then you invite stump speeches. So the idea of having the short answers was to not allow them to fall into just delivering their standard
answers.
But
Matthew Connetti, what about the idea of asking each other questions?
Well, I think it's a good idea. In fact, it's been floated by John McCain, who earlier this summer, pledged to hold 10 different debates across the country, various formats, town hall formats. And this it was a political gambit, absolutely, because he understood that Obama would not accept it. Because the Obama campaign has been operating under the assumption that this election is theirs to lose. And so when you're ahead, and it's a safe assumption, I think, so when you're ahead, you want to limit your exposure. And that's what Barack Obama has done with the press and in terms of
just to interject debates. Here, the Obama campaign went back at the McCain campaign and said they would do two of those town hall meetings. And again, that would even be unprecedented before either candidate even received the party's nomination. And they claim they never heard back from the McCain campaign. So political gambits, both sides.
So a town hall meeting would allow people in the audience to simply ask their own questions.
Yes, and we saw that during the many debates during the primaries.
Okay, it's Bob Schieffer who is moderating the third debate in Hempstead, New York, and now Fox is confirming Palin as vice president, as the vice presidential nominee to our John McCain. Let's now go, let's see, to Little Rock, Arkansas. Carol, you're on the air.
Hello, good morning.
Morning. Go quickly, please.
How are you?
Please go quickly to your question.
I'm sorry.
That's
all
right.
I can't hear you. Okay, I just want to make one comment.
Sure.
And my comment is that I'm voting Democrat, and I was a Hillary fan, and I'm still a Hillary fan, and I'm just so impressed with the Democrat convention, and I just don't understand why the Republicans just don't get it. Their plan is just not working. And so I think he made a good decision on picking Joe Biden.
Thanks for calling. How often do conventions change people's minds, Eleanor?
Well, Bill Clinton got an enormous bump, in part because Ross Perot dropped out soon after. But Al Gore made up an 11-point deficit. John Kerry didn't get anything out of his convention. So I think they can have an impact, and going right into the Republican week does tend to step on the Democrats' momentum.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy, by the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to improve the nation's foster care system to help children find safe, permanent families at pewtrusts.org, and by the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Friday News Roundup. The U.S. is set to turn over security for Anbar province to the Iraqi military. Russia's recognition of two separatist regions in Georgia escalates tensions with the West, and fighting spreads to a third tribal area along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And the Associated Press is now confirming that Governor Palin of Alaska will be John McCain's running mate, and that announcement will come when, in fact, there is a rally at noon in Ohio. What do you think that means for John McCain's chances, Naftali? Does it change the equation?
I think it certainly changes the equation. It's pretty hard to quantify whether it directly improves or hurts his chances, but it brings I think a lot of his campaign has been sort of a roll the dice type campaign, a feeling that the odds were against him because it's such a Democratic year, so he's going to break some rules, take some chances. I think he's sort of that kind of a freewheeling seat of the pants type campaigner to begin with. And so I think he's really rolling the dice here. I mean, he's picking someone who is, again, has a star quality. She's youthful. She would break, you know, no matter who gets elected, we're going to break a pretty major barrier in the next election now. We'll either have the first woman vice president or the first African-American president. And I think it draws a lot of attention, and I think it does change the way that the whole campaign looks. You know, it's interesting. Barack Obama, who was youthful and inexperienced, picked somebody who was older and experienced. And McCain, who had age and experience as both his assets and his liabilities, picked somebody more in the mold of his opponent who was young and inexperienced. So each campaign has, in a way, sought to shore up its liabilities by picking somebody more like the opposing party's main candidate.
And, Elner, the McCain campaign is now confirming Palin as the vice presidential choice. What does this do as far as the women's vote is concerned? Perhaps many of those disaffected Hillary Clinton voters.
Well, as Hillary Clinton said in her speech the other day, were you for me because of me or because of the issues that I stand for? And again, now we have, I guess, an unrelievedly pro-life ticket. And I imagine the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade and overturning Roe v. Wade will definitely come up. And a lot will depend on Governor Palin and how she performs on the campaign trail and in the debates. Will she turn out to be another Dan Quayle, who's clearly will be seen as not up to it, or will she, you know, dazzle us all with her command of the issues and give people a sense that she would be ready to step into the job if necessary?
Matt Continetti.
I should point out that, of course, when Dan Quayle went up against Loy Benson in 1988, the contrast was clear between Quayle's inexperience and Benson's. Freudian slip. Benson's experience and you know, skill as a politician. But, of course, George H.W. Bush won the 1988 election. The vice presidential picks don't, in the end, truly matter. But I think Naftali is right to point out that this is a barrier-breaking pick. It's a direct play for Hillary Clinton supporters, though they may end up disagreeing with the ticket on the issue of abortion. And let's not forget the glamour quality that Sarah Palin brings. This is a former beauty queen. She has a definite style and grace about her. I think America is going to like this pick.
Now, this is interesting from Jim in Cleveland, Ohio, who's listening on WCPN. He says, once again, McCain is running away from himself and making decisions by political calculation instead of personal conviction. I was a McCain fan in the past, but I'm disappointed. Interesting comment.
I don't know necessarily that you can conclude that based on this vice presidential pick, but you can certainly, if you look at the last 8 years, the John McCain of 2008 is not the John McCain of 2000 on a variety of issues. And I think that's a case that the Democrats are going to be making over the coming months.
All right, let's go back to the phones to Syracuse, New York. Good morning, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to say, in reference to Barack Obama's speech, I saw it last night. I think it was a great speech. I was very impressed, and I'm impressed by this speech as being able to show how Obama is able to make change for this country. One of George Bush's problems throughout the 8 years he's been president is his inarticulate nature as a speaker. And I think to many people, his inarticulateness as a speaker is the face of his incompetence as a leader and his incompetence as a president. And I think Obama showed with his speech last night that this terrible era for America is over. Now, maybe McCain and his new vice president, Governor Palin, will also be able to do this. We'll find this out next week. But I think Obama showed, at least rhetorically and at least in terms of his public presentation, that he is able to be president. And he did that very, very well.
Matt Continetti.
I think the caller raises an excellent point. You know, there's this adage in politics that Americans always correct for the failings of the previous president. Jimmy Carter was the malaise president, so we got the sunny Ronald Reagan. Reaganism seemed harsh for some, so George H.W. Bush promised 1,000 points of light. George H.W. Bush turned out not to care for people's problems, so we elected the emphatic Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton had some moral failings, so we elected the born-again George W. Bush. George W. Bush can't really give an impromptu speech without stumbling on his words. So we may end up electing a candidate in Barack Obama who is definitely eloquent, may not even go far enough. So I think that is a fair point. I would say, though, just as an aside, if you look at some of the images coming from the speech, there are parts where Obama didn't seem very happy. It was a tough speech. There's no doubt about it. And, of course, the most ringing line for me was when he yelled, basically, enough. And I think that a lot of, that will resonate with a lot of voters, definitely be a soundbite. But he could have been a little bit more positive, in my opinion.
Eltner?
Well, I think he needed to show that he had the steel to take the case to John McCain, and I don't think you do that with a big smile on your face. So I thought his bodily language was appropriate.
All right, to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi there, Brian.
Good morning, Diane, and
morning.
Good morning, guest.
Morning, sir.
I plan on seeing Barack Obama, and bravo to him on a great convention and in Battle Creek on Sunday. But my comment had to do with former President Bill Clinton when he said the world was more impressed with the U.S. power of example than our example of power. I really think that strikes a chord with me and with many other Democrats. Thank you.
Naftali.
Well, I do think I thought that was one of the great lines of the speech, too. And, of course, and one of the subtopics of this whole campaign has been the use of American power and when it's wise to use it and when it's not wise to use it. And President Clinton made quite a point of saying that Obama would be able to use it but would do so as a last resort. And in general, I think it was a well-done speech, and not only on behalf of Senator Obama, but I think this speech was also Bill Clinton's way of saying, I'm still here, I'm back, I'm still really good. You know, there was a lot of criticism during the primary campaign by former supporters of President Clinton that he'd lost it, that he was not only doing things that were inappropriate, but that he'd lost his political touch. And I think in some ways this was a virtuoso display by an old master whose skills had been questioned in recent months.
Now, it's interesting. We're getting lots of emails that sort of ring with his same tone. This one from Jen sort of sums it up. She says, if the Republicans think that a woman vice president will gain them votes from the Hillary supporters, they must think we're really dumb. I think the gesture is insincere and insulting. Women voters are smart enough to see when they are being manipulated. I find this tactic insulting. I hope this backfires on them. We care about issues as well as gender. Might this backfire, Eleanor?
Well, I think that's very well said. I mean, those are the dangers that are posed in this selection. But I think, you know, the McCain campaign has made the calculation that unless they do, to use the cliche, a game changer, they could be out of this. And I know the polls are tight, but my sense is that McCain is sort of hit his ceiling and Obama is at his floor. I mean, I think if one of the other candidates is poised to take off, it's more likely to be Obama.
All right. To Jacksonville, North Carolina. Good morning, Will.
How you doing?
Good.
Just calling real quick to make a comment about this whole election in general. In average, the U.S. military is over 50% Republican. That's the average. And for whatever reason, now in this election, I'm going to vote Republican because experience. McCain's got—he was a Navy captain, which is a colonel in the Marine Corps and Army. And that's a lot of experience there. Plus, you've got over 20 years of, you know, congressional experience. In the military, we wouldn't put a captain or a lieutenant in charge of a division. You put a colonel or a general, someone who has.
Oh, dear. Have we lost you?
Yeah, and it's not about, you know, Democrat, Republican in this one, because if, you know, Congressman Webb, James Webb, if he ran, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat because he has experience. So, and he, to say that Obama's going to make changes, he has no, you know, experience to make changes. He doesn't know, if you're going to go, you know, I use...
Okay, Will, I think we get it, and you're fading on us, Naftali. Is this election going to be about military and congressional experience?
You know, I really don't think it is, at least not directly. Americans seem to have a mixed record of whether they elect the most experienced candidate in traditional terms or not. But I think this is a time when people have made it clear that they feel a need for some kind of change. And I think really what it's going to be about is whether or not Senator Obama can show that he hits a certain threshold of competence, trustworthiness, strength, toughness. So it's not about overall experience in general, but it's about, particularly on Senator Obama's part, proving that he has a certain level that Americans can feel comfortable with.
When people express their reservations about Obama, they say experience. Experience may be a surrogate for a whole lot of other doubts about him. But in the speech last night, Obama talked about judgment and temperament. And I suspect we're going to hear more about that.
And there's a question on that from Bob in Alexandria, Virginia. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
The press seems to have a constant drumbeat that voters don't know enough about Senator Obama, but shouldn't the press also be asking more questions about Senator McCain? For example, I would like to know if Senator McCain is still affected by and being treated for the psychological damage he suffered as a result of the torture and confinement he endured as a POW in North Vietnam.
Matt Continetti.
Well, the press is focused on Obama. I'd like to see more coverage of McCain, personally. Obama is the overwhelming favorite in coverage. The press has seemed to have concluded that Obama is the story, and he is the story in a lot of ways. People know John McCain. They don't know Barack Obama.
Well, that
this is a guy who's just appeared on the scene.
Well, that storyline works to the advantage of John McCain, because if this election is seen as a referendum on Barack Obama instead of 8 years of Republicans, and it's not seen as a choice between two men, but on whether Obama is up to the job, that does not work to Obama's advantage. So John McCain ought to thank the heavens for every inch of newsprint he doesn't get.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. On the other hand, Naftali Ben-David, Bob is asking a specific question, and that is in regard to post-traumatic stress syndrome and the aftermath of McCain's experience as a POW. How much do we know about that? There have been reports throughout the years, even before he became a presidential contender, that his outbursts of temper in public as well as in private did not serve him well.
Well, I think there's two different issues there. There's John McCain's temperament, which we can all talk about and evaluate, and he certainly has been known to have outbursts of temper, and that's part of his sort of freewheeling style, I think. But there's also the question of post-traumatic stress disorder. And as far as I know, that's a non-issue. I mean, he's opened up his medical records. There are things in there talking about that. There's no evidence that he suffers from anything like that. Some of those stories have been raised by his political opponents. So in my mind, that isn't really an issue. And I think that voters probably won't and shouldn't make up their mind on that basis.
Yeah, I think he has been examined repeatedly, and that's a number of years ago, and he has opened his record. So I don't think that line of inquiry goes anywhere.
All right, and to New Orleans, Louisiana. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Diana. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I'll tell you, I've been listening to the convention all week and on the radio primarily because I'm traveling around and on my way back into the city. One thing that struck me about this convention, actually all the way back to when Joe Biden was selected, is a real respect for the voters that I have not felt for certainly the last 8 years. The idea that we're worth working for, instead of this kind of paternalistic condescension that certainly we in New Orleans have felt coming from the governor, the government, the federal government, the state, as well as the city government, that, you know, you don't understand, we'll take care of you, but really just leave it up to us. You know, Joe Biden and Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, just a feeling that we're worth working for and that we're respected and that our opinion matters. And I was hoping your panel might discuss, maybe it's that reaction idea that was brought up earlier, that the candidate we'll vote for now is a response to how we've been treated by the last president.
Matt Continetti.
Yeah, I saw what I found with this convention was a real stress on middle class, working class families and their economic concerns. Over the last few years, they've seen their prices rise, and they've seen their income stagnate. I mean, these facts are undeniable. And the Democrats have a message, and Obama's, I think, most powerful message. Let's forget about national security debates. Let's forget about most domestic policy debates. His most powerful tool in this election is his accurate claim that his tax policy, which will raise taxes overall, will also cut taxes for the middle class. And that is a weakness for John McCain. His tax policy is not a middle class tax cut. And so on the merits, in my opinion, and also on the politics, the more that Obama stresses that economic message, the more to his advantage it will be.
5 seconds, Hillary.
Yeah, a Democrat running on tax cuts for 95% of Americans is a powerful message, and one that goes against the grain of stereotypes of Democrats.
Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Naftali Ben-David of the Chicago Tribune, and Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard. He edits that magazine's Campaign Standard blog. Thank you all so much, and we'll see you when you get back from Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks a lot. And thanks to all of you for listening. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.